This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to Dave's Book Talk, and today we're going to talk to Mark Sullivan. Yeah, he's normally a thriller writer. He has written a book called Beneath a Scarlet Sky. It's a beautiful red cover. It is published by Lake Union, and he's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, it's good to have you on. It's been oh, maybe 20 years since I've talked to you. I can't believe it's been that long. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's been that long. You normally write thrillers, and I think, did you do some spy books too?
I've done some espionage books and thriller, mostly thrillers, suspense thrillers by myself and with James Patterson.
Right. So this is a total departure for you.
It is, yes.
Why did this come about? Why did you want to write this, and where did the idea come from?
Well, I heard this story on the worst day of my life. My younger brother and best friend had drunk himself to death. I'd written a novel that no one liked, and I was on the verge of personal bankruptcy. And driving to a Costco one snowy day in February of 2006, I realized I was worth more dead than alive. And I thought swerving into a bridge abutment was a good idea, so my family could collect on the insurance. Thankfully, you know, images of my wife and son stopped me, and but I pulled over into that Costco parking lot as rattled as I've ever been. And I put my head on the steering wheel, and I begged God and the universe for a story.
Oh, my God. This really happened?
This really happened.
Is it hard for you to talk about this?
You know, 10 years ago it certainly was. I've gotten better at it. I'm a private person. I don't usually open up about this, but this is how it happened. And so I begged for a story, and I went home, was in no mood to do anything, and my wife forced me to go to a dinner party. She was sick and said, you know, we've canceled on three times, you've got to go. And I went there, and I'm not there 20 minutes, and this guy starts telling me the snippets of this story about Pino Lella, and I'm dumbfounded. And then I don't believe it, and but then I find out he's alive, and that's how it happened.
Wait a minute, this guy really existed?
Pino Lella, for sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
He's still alive. Yes. It's historical fiction. You know, I there was a lot of things that were missing or I couldn't understand. A lot of people had died even by the time I got to the story, which was 60 years after the fact. And a lot of the documents surrounding the story, the Nazis had burned in the last 4 or 5 days of the war. So I decided that, look, the story came to a novelist. I'm going to write it as a novel. And then I found out shortly, right around that time, that Schindler's List was written as a novel. And I said, okay, that's how I'm doing it. And that's how I can bring the story to life.
So how did you get a lot of response from it after you finished it? I mean, did you get a lot of publishers that wanted to publish it?
They didn't understand it. You know, they didn't understand it at first. And, you know, my oldest son is a very sharp guy, and he kept saying, Dad, you're going to want to take it to Amazon. And the reason he said that was that I wrote down two things that I wanted in a publisher. One was I had to have an editor who was as passionate about the story as I was, and two, they had to be able to put it in as many hands as possible. And I got that. Lake Union is publishing arm of Amazon, and they're incredibly professional and good. A great publishing experience for me, and the book has been downloaded, you know, more than almost 400,000 times.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh my God! So you're up there on the bestseller list with this for Amazon,
now,
anyway.
A lot of it happened during the Kindle first month, where people with Amazon Prime can get it. But again, my goal is get people reading it, and I've already got, you know, more than, as I said, almost 400,000.
So that's 400,000 from what time frame are we talking about that they started downloading it?
They started April 1st.
Oh my gosh. So it's been, this has made quite a splash then.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. I didn't realize you had that many downloads, that it was doing. See, as the person who interviews, you never know how the book's doing. You don't always know how the book's doing. But
sure.
Because a lot of times I interview the author right at the beginning of the tour or the beginning of the promotion, so you don't know what's going on with the book. And I've had more than a couple authors tell me they don't even know the sales a lot of times. So
right.
That's amazing.
It's very gratifying because my goal was to tell this Pinot story to as many people as possible. So.
The book.
I
must tell you though, after reading your book, I had trouble finding another good book, and I was like missing your writing.
Oh well, thank you.
And I thought, well, God, why does he do this to me? He's torturing me because the story was so good. Now I want more.
Yeah.
I want another story just like this.
Yeah.
And it's a long book too. It's 500. It's over 500 pages, but it's sure one of the most fascinating books you'll ever read.
Yeah. Thank you. That's the way I responded to it 10 years ago when I first heard the little bit. And, you know, I mean, here's the story about this 17-year-old kid who goes to this Catholic boys' school in the Alps and ends up leading Jews escaping Nazi-occupied Italy. And then through these extraordinary circumstances in the spring-summer of 1944, he becomes a spy inside the German high command. And falls in love with a woman who will haunt them the rest of his life.
I mean, but there's so many. I mean, there's things I can't talk about because I'll ruin the little part of the book. But there are things in this book that happen, and you start to wonder, you know, what's really going on here? Who's manipulating who, and who's, you know? And it's a very interesting way your mind works while you're reading this book.
Good.
And you, that's what you wanted. You wanted to feel that way.
Well, I set out to try to. Listening to Pinot's story the first time, and just about every time, has always reduced me to tears, to be honest. And it was an incredible emotional journey for him to go on to tell me the story. And I'll give you one example. Pinot himself is a very gregarious, big, strapping guy, you know, even at 90, 91. And he... this was 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when I was first over there starting the research in the book, and I'd been there about 12 days, and we went out to dinner with Pinot's ex-wife, who's also his best friend, Yvonne, and we were driving along, and, you know, Pinot's usually, you know, as I said, very gregarious, loves to talk and tell stories, and he's sitting there in the front seat with his shoulders kind of slumped, and Yvonne says, "Pinot, what's the matter with you?" And he looks over and says, "Yvonne, you've known me almost 40 years. How many times have you seen me cry?" And she said, "Cry? I've never seen you cry." And he looked over his shoulder at me and he said, "Mark, you've known me less than 2 weeks. How many times have you seen me cry?" And I said, 9 or 10. And she almost crashed the car. And then she got kind of angry at me because it was apparent that I had heard a story that, you know, his best friend and ex-wife had never heard.
Huh.
Just an amazing emotional journey to go on, and my goal was to take the reader on that same emotional journey.
No, you're telling me that Pinot is still alive?
Yes, I'm going to see him in 2 weeks.
And how old is he now?
He's 91.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
I hope you're going to post like pictures on your...
Oh, definitely.
On your website, because I'd love to see that. I cannot believe he's still alive.
Yeah, we're bringing him, you know, the book, basically. So.
But he has not read the book yet?
He's read the book.
Oh, he has read the book, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What's been his reaction to it?
I mean, he's amazed by it. He's amazed that I actually stuck with it for a decade and wrote it. He's truly amazed by the reaction that people are having. His son, Michael, for the past month or so, has been getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to call him in Milan and read him the reviews, and he's somewhat embarrassed, and yet he wants to hug everybody who wrote a review, good or bad. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Now, I mean, that just clears up everything, all the things I had when I was reading the book, all the, and I must admit, I felt some anger at you. But
yeah.
Now I understand it a lot more. Now it becomes a lot clearer to me.
Yeah.
But I can't go into any more detail as far as what I mean by that.
Sure.
People will understand after they read the book, because there's things that I don't want to reveal. But, you know,
he goes through some really brutal experiences.
Are there even some that weren't included in the book?
Yes.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I can only, now you got me curious as to what they are. But it is, I mean, there are times in the book when it's, you feel like things are going to totally come apart for him.
Yes.
And he's confronted by different things, and you're thinking, wow, how's he ever going to get out of this one?
Yeah.
But now that you tell me that it's all true, and it puts it even more in first perspective.
Yeah, it's historical fiction, right? So, I mean, you know, I was forced, like, you know, he went on many more escapes than are depicted in the novel. So the novel depicts compressed events, a couple of compressed characters on the escapes, so that I could tell you the full breadth of the emotional story.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So those were the kinds of issues that I had to make decisions for the sake of some of the narrative work that flowed, and the story was, you know, comprehensible to a reader who only has time for 527 pages. And even at that, I think I was asking a lot of people to read that.
No, but it's such a beautiful, it's such a wonderful story, though. I mean, it's just so, like I said, once you're done it, you're like, wow, I want something else by this man. I want to experience. I mean, Purification Ceremony was amazing. I mean, that book is just, if anybody hasn't read it, they should go out and get it now. That's what introduced me to you. That's what made me think, wow, this man can really write. And there's just something about that book. I can't even explain what it is, other than the fact that it's a completely compelling story, just like Beneath the Scarlet Sky.
Right.
Now, I mean, and I don't usually read a lot of historical stuff, so the fact that I was able to read this means you must have done a great job with it, because I don't read a lot of historical fiction.
Right.
Because I don't. And one of the reasons I don't is because I don't know a lot about history. And you think I would want to know more, and I do. But I get confused with all the dates and the things that happen, and I can't keep it all straight in my head. Maybe that doesn't make any sense to you. But
No, it makes sense. I had to create all sorts of time charts so I'd understand what was happening at the same time. You know, it was in a given place, and, you know, it was complicated, but it was worth it, because I felt when I was writing, certainly the final drafts, like I had taken the reader into Italy in World War II, and they were actually, you know, there. And that's been, you know, largely the experience that people say they're having reading the book.
And if you hadn't gone to this party, none of this would have happened.
None of it would have happened.
So you have your wife to thank for that one.
I do, all the time.
Forcing it. And how difficult must have been for you to go to that party. You didn't feel like partying.
No. No, I went because I was forced to. Quite literally. She just said, you gotta go. You haven't been out of the house. Go. So I went.
Yeah, and you can only imagine what she went through this whole time. You know, watching you be... I don't think there's anything worse than watching somebody you love be so tortured like you were.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult for her, but she's always been the best part of my life. She's always been the person who stood behind me 100%. So it, you know, it makes sense on a cosmic level that she would force me to go.
Does it help to talk about this, even with me? I mean, just to talk about this time of your life, does it ease the pain at all a little bit?
You know, it was very difficult. Matthew's death, my brother, was it hit me much, much harder than I ever expected something like that to hit me, and it was prolonged. You know, we were only 20 months apart, 22 months apart, and so we were close to Irish twins, as they call them, and we were inseparable as children, so his death hit me very, very hard, and, you know, it almost, I had to go there so that I could begin to understand what Pino Lella must have gone through, and did go through.
I can't even imagine the horror of that. I mean, what you went through, and you, I'm sure today you still miss him.
Oh, I do. And I wish he could have read this book. And I'd love to read.
That's the horribleness of losing a loved one. You never really do get over it. I mean, you just go on and you find a way to deal with it. But I've had people say they get over things like that, and I don't think you really ever do.
No.
Not completely.
No, not completely.
So how do you, your wife knew what you were going through. How do you explain to your children what you were like at that point? I mean, is that difficult to talk to them about it?
Well, not now. I mean, they were all 14 and 12 when this all happened. Now they understand. They've both read, both my sons and my nephew, who was living with me at the time, have read the book. And, you know, they'll tell you that it helps explain what I was going through and why. I managed to hide most of it, you know, but enough of it got through.
So what year did you start writing this book?
Well, I started when I came back from Italy in 2006, but I realized quickly I had to go and start getting corroboration places, and that took time. I had to raise money to make trips. I was also impeded by the fact that, you know, Pino, as you might expect, having gone through this, had, you know, I came to believe, and I do believe, that he suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic shock. And he, you know, like most people with post-traumatic shock, they'll bury things deep. And he buried two things, and one of them was Anna's name, the maid, at first, and then Leia's name, the general, at first. And he came up with Anna Marta within maybe 4 days of us starting to talk. I just kept pressing him and asking him, and he'd get physically uncomfortable, and finally it came out. And but the general was a tough one, because Pino kept remembering him as Mon Generale, and he said they would go anywhere, and, you know, they would salute him. Even the SS would salute Layers when he would come in, and they always called him Kaufman or Hauptmann, and he didn't understand what it, he doesn't speak German, you know, beyond basic stuff, and he didn't understand it. And so it took about 2.5-3 years before I was able to raise enough money, and I'm still working on it and working on other stuff. And I raised the money to go to Germany to spend time in the Nazi war archives in Berlin and Friedrichsburg. And I'm working with a kid who's a Fulbright scholarship over there, American, friend of mine's son, very super bright, totally fluent German. And we started finding documents about Layers in Friedrichsburg with his signature over the word Hauptmann. And we couldn't figure that out at first, because that's a military designation in German of captain. And he was by no means a captain. And so we were trying to figure it out. And then we gradually were able to put two and two together, that if your name was over that designation, Hauptmann, then you were the boss. That's the other word it means in German. Hauptmann means captain, and it also means boss. And then right then is when Nick Sullivan, no relation, the Fulbright guy, figured it out, what Kaufman was, and that was, it was a homonym. Pino thought they were saying K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N, and they were saying K-O-P-F-M-A-N-N, which means headman or boss. So once we found Layer's photograph and took it to him, he ID'd him as Mon Generale, and, you know, then I was actually off and going. I had to spend a bunch of time in the U.S. archives. I had to hire archivists in Rome at the U.S. Archives. Then I went and visited the British Archives so I could understand the bombing campaign. And then I started to write in earnest about 3.5 years ago.
I can see this book becoming an epic movie like Schindler's List was. I mean, it's thrilling to even think of somebody filming this.
I know, isn't it? It's just epic and monumental. And yeah, I don't know if it's a film or if it's like a, you know, 10-part, 8-part series on Netflix or something. But
yeah, it's definitely something. I mean, it's something somebody should explore doing.
Yeah, yeah, we've had a lot of interest in that, but nothing yet.
I guess the question is, how do you get this book to the people that would do something like that? I mean, what do you just send them copies and make sure they get them and read it?
Basically, but you just wait, you know. There are people who are scouts who are looking for this kind of thing. And we've had people, I have friends in the industry who've read it and passed it on to people. And it's so close to home that I'm being very patient with it, because I want it to be the right people who are going to make it the right way.
Right. So you know when it is the right people, do you think?
I will. I'll know it. I'll know it. Because I knew my editor, you know, how she reacted. And she was awesome. And so I think I'll know. And I was very comfortable giving her the story.
You're a very interesting man, even more so than I knew. And it's been years since I talked to you. And I know you're an outdoors type of guy. I mean, do you mountain climbing, or have you done it in the past?
Yeah, I've done it in the past.
So how much of what is described in the book have you actually done?
Oh, almost all of it. I mean, I was unable to climb the ridge because it's inside a ski area.
Mm-hmm.
Now. But I was able to ski into it, you know, all along the route. I was able to get right up next to the climbing routes, just coming in from the sides. So I would take photographs, and I took movies of it, and I know how they went up.
Right. And I mean, those scenes are fascinating to read. I mean, you're just like, how did these people get through this? I mean, how would you do something you've never done before in your life?
Right.
I mean, mountain climbing is something you just don't go out and do.
In the dark? No. They started in the dark. That was, and a lot of them were wearing street shoes.
That's insane.
It is. And they went right up over the top. But you'd have to see it. It's like a spine. And the spine is where the wind blows, so a lot of it got blown off, so it was exposed rock. But I've been at the top, and I've filmed it looking back down the ridge, and I hadn't looked at that film in probably 8 years, and I looked the other day, and I was stunned at how steep it was.
I think about Pino, and he seems to be fearless. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything that scares this man at all. I mean,
well, think about, first, I wondered about that. But he did get scared, for sure. But he was always able to conquer it. And part of this, I think, is just because he's 17 years old. And if you've ever been around 17-year-old boys, there's not a lot of things they're going to not try. They'll do just about anything. Oh, jump off that cliff. Oh, sure, I'll do that.
Right.
There's not a lot of common sense, because they say physiologically your frontal lobe isn't fully developed. So your judgment is off that you will do things that, you know.
Oh, that's scary.
Less scary. But, you know, he had been in the mountains since he was a little kid. He would go up there to Father Ray's all the time, and he learned how to mountaineer, he learned how to ski. He was a tremendous skier. I mean, you just can't overestimate how good a skier this guy was.
But you never get the feeling when he's on the mountain that he's actually really afraid of the mountain. He's actually afraid of doing it.
No, because if you're 17 and you've been doing this since five or six, you know, it's like my kids on a mountain at 17, just spectacular skiers. You know, they wouldn't hesitate to do something like that.
Huh. How about your wife? Does she do all that outdoor stuff?
No, she does outdoor stuff, but she doesn't mountain climb.
Yeah.
Not snow, anyway.
I wonder how many women actually do mountain climb. There's probably
a lot in Bozeman, where I live, a lot.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
You'd think of women having more fear, I would think, but they don't. Some of them don't. They don't have any fear.
Well, some of them are the best rock climbers you've ever seen.
Have you rock climbed with women?
No, I don't rock climb. I mountaineer.
Right.
I don't rock climb.
Have you mountaineered with women?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I didn't know whether you.
Yeah.
You're pretty. Are you pretty much fearless yourself?
No, I'm an odds player. I look at a thing and I look at it and I try to determine my own odds. And if the odds are against me, I don't do it.
Is that right? So you're not a gambler?
No.
Because gambling, the odds are pretty much against you in gambling, I would think.
Right.
So why bother? You know? But, I mean, this is such a great story, and I think to myself, have you done like bookstore signings and met a lot of people?
Yeah, it's just starting to pick up. I went and did an audition that could get me onto a book circuit where I'd go and speak in various synagogues and churches. We'll see. I think it went really well. And the idea is to generate as many speaking engagements as I can. Because, again, my goal is to tell Pino's story to as many people as possible. In any shape or form, I'll talk about him.
And that's amazing. And you've opened yourself up to that. That's great. That's really great. I mean, I have a lot of trouble getting authors on for my show here. So sometimes,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes they'll talk, sometimes they won't. And yeah, the more popular they are, the less likely they are that they want to spend time. So it's the fact that you want to is very good. I wonder, this is your 18th or 19th book?
18.
So I'm wondering, the next book, is the next book going to be difficult to write because this was such a powerful story?
I don't know. I haven't started it yet. I don't know. I outlined a thriller. I like it. I'm not sure I'm going to write it right away. I'm looking for another story that it can move people and uplift them. That's really what I'm interested in.
So something on the same lines as Beneath.
Yeah.
And do you think that's going to be hard to find?
Yeah, I do.
I asked that question. I feel like I'm being stupid. That of course it's going to be hard to find. It's like when you've written something so monumental, how do you go beyond that monumental?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm about to find out, you know. But I was so challenged, and I had to bring my game to another level with Beneath. And you know, once you've done that, that's what you want to try to do again.
So finding the editor that helped you with this book, how long was the process? How long did that take?
Well, let me see. You know, they bought it in January of 2015. Is that right? 16.
The time goes so fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know. And we worked on it. 6 months, 7 months. It was more like, you know, we got it to Amazon, and I signed a deal. Then Amazon hired an outside editor who was fantastic, and he read it, and he only had a couple of, wasn't even major, they were minor things, but I thought they were great. And so I did that, and then he read it again, you know, page one all the way through, came back with a series of, you know, suggestions, edits, and I went through that, and then, you know, then it starts to go into the regular publishing cycle with a copy editor and fact checkers and everything else. So it was, you know, from the time we sold it to the time it was, quote, done, it was probably 9 months, 10, 11 months.
People, I guess people don't realize what you go through to write and get a book published. It's not as easy as it looks. You know,
no.
There's a lot of stuff you go through. There's a lot of, you know, you have to be able to take criticism.
Yes, you do.
And it maybe it's warranted, maybe it isn't. I mean, you sound like you pretty much know when it is or isn't.
Yeah, it'll hit me right away. I mean, I get what they're trying to do. I've been at this, you know, close to 30 years. So I mean, if you get a great editor, boy, they'll save you and they'll make you better. So I always go in with that attitude, that they're going to save me and make me better. And so far, so good.
Now, as far as it being in bookstores, will people find this in bookstores anywhere?
Depends on the bookstore.
Yeah. I know that Barnes & Noble pretty much,
no.
You'd have to special order it to them. And I'm not even what's that?
Right, that's correct.
And I don't know that they would. I've had some Barnes & Noble employees be upset about Amazon. And you know what? But Amazon produces such great, great books. I mean, and this is one of them. But, you know, it's like, how do you turn away something that's so great? You can't. You just can't. I mean,
Yeah. When
you love to read something, and it doesn't matter who's publishing it, it's the fact that you love it and want to promote it that makes the difference.
Right.
It's not And it's not based on who it is and whether there's competition or whatever, you know? I mean, it's...
If they read it, I absolutely agree with you. If I can get them to read it, I agree with you.
Right. So, but I don't... Are you getting more responses from women or men readers?
Seems to be about split.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of women readers. A lot of women readers. Probably 60-40 women and men.
Now, what do you get, letters or do you get emails normally?
Both. Yeah, they contact me through my website or on Facebook.
And see, but nowadays when it's so easy to contact people and, you know, and it's... And I've talked to you on the internet, and it still blows my mind when I'm actually able to talk to an author and tell him what I think of their book, you know, and it's... Because, you know, nobody writes letters anymore.
Sure.
I mean, you can probably find two or three people that still do, but it's a lost art.
Yeah, I mean, I got a nice letter from a historian, where was he at? University of North Carolina, and Chapel Hill, and you know, he wrote me this really great letter and said, man, this was a historical tour de force. And he said that. He tracked my down and sent it to my house. So I was pretty thrilled about that.
Did you cry while you wrote the book?
Oh, yeah.
Very emotional.
Very emotional story.
Was there any point at all where you had trouble going on?
I didn't have trouble. I would say that I found the challenges of it daunting at times, because I knew what I was trying to do. I was trying to, you know, bring the reader to World War Italy,
mm-hmm.
and to have them experience it. And you know, sometimes I could do that just through the sheer force of the story, and sometimes I had to do it through sheer force of research, you know, or just trying to write it in the best way that I possibly could.
Did you need to go like in the like Hitler, like Mussolini, and I mean Hitler's not really a lot in the book. He's mentioned a number of times, but he's not really a central character. But
no.
Did you have to go and research Mussolini to try to understand why he was like the way he was?
Oh yeah, definitely.
I mean, what an interesting character.
Right.
And it seemed very, very conceited.
Yeah, well, he was a dictator, right?
Yeah. But then I guess usually...
At that point, he's a puppet dictator. He's not even in control. Right? Adolf Hitler's in control, and Hitler's generals are in control, and Mussolini is not.
You know, you're very good at listening to me. A lot of times when I interview an author, they only want to talk. They want to talk about their book, which is fine. But I don't get much of a chance to respond. And you're a very good listener. That's very important.
Yeah, I think so. Well, thank you.
And it's very refreshing because sometimes I can't even get a word in. There's authors that I've talked to, and it's like they just can talk forever. But they almost want you to listen to them completely and just ignore everything you say, which is kind of weird when you think about it, especially when you have so many questions you want to ask.
Sure.
So I'm just floored by this whole thing. I didn't know this whole story was actually all true. I mean, that I guess I didn't read enough about the book before, and I was so absorbed in the book that I didn't really think about that. I knew that everything that was happening in the book really happened to a great extent as far as the historical stuff, but I didn't know whether all the characters were really real people.
Right. Yeah.
I can't imagine what Pino would be like to meet. I mean, to meet him would be a thrill.
It is a thrill. He's an amazing guy.
Has he always been the same kind of guy his whole life? I mean, has he always been...
Yeah, he went through some times when he was in his 30s where he would, you know, get angry a lot. And part of that, I think, is the PTSD. You know, and then he'd go right back to his genial self. But he felt the need to wander a lot. He liked to go and see new things and do new stuff. And he's just one of those people that amazing people seem to gravitate toward him. I've had people in praise and in criticism compare him to Forrest Gump. And, you know, the first time I went to Italy to listen to the story, I by the second or third day, I was to myself. I was calling him the Italian Forrest Gump.
Well, I can only imagine. I'd love to see a picture of Anna.
We all would.
And does he have pictures of her?
No.
Oh, he doesn't.
No.
So do we know what she looks like?
Yes.
So you do have a picture of her?
No, I had to go on his description of her.
Oh, okay. So you haven't actually seen a physical picture is what I was trying to get at.
No.
Interesting. But she, I mean, from the way you describe her, was very beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. 4-6 years older than a beautiful from Trieste. Sandy blonde-haired girl.
Right. This, I mean, you would like to write a book like this for the rest of your life, wouldn't you?
You bet.
I mean, just find a story after story after story. And you being a newspaper, you were a newspaper reporter at one point, weren't you?
I was.
Yeah, so you have that curiosity, you have that ambition to find the next story.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of a feeler for another story right now?
There's some that I've got, like, sitting there that I'm interested in, but I'm waiting for one that just blows me away. Because, it, you know, who knows? It could take me 10 years. I hope that it's not. I hope it's a two or three-year process. But I'm, you know, a lot of people are contacting me with stories, as you might imagine, and asking me to write about their father. And, you know, and I'm not discouraging anybody until I hear what's going on. I know it'll come. I know there's a story out there for me.
There's something there that somebody's going to, I mean, something's going to, it's going to be, it may not be like the party before where you have an epiphany like that or a moment where you knew. When you first heard the story, you must have known, well, I can really write this.
Well, I mean, I was just shocked by it. I was, you know, I was like, how could this story have never been told? And then I was skeptical, highly skeptical, and then I learned that he was alive and got to him, and I think it was probably halfway through that first trip in Italy that I knew it, you know, it had the potential to be an extraordinary story, because not only did I have the chance to tell Pino Lella's story, but to tell it in the context of what was happening historically in Italy,
mm-hmm.
which I knew nothing about. You know, other than Mussolini. You know, I knew there was a guy Mussolini, and I knew he died, and they strung him up upside down in the Piazzale Loreto. That was it.
That's how old was he when he died, by the way?
Who?
Mussolini.
He had to have been in the late 50s or early 60s.
Okay. There's not a sense in the book of how old he actually was. I really didn't know.
Yeah.
And so I was curious to see, you know, what... But did you actually go and visit all the sites that are in the book?
Yes.
Really? Every one?
Yes.
And what... So that made it easier to write the book, because you actually were there and you could actually feel... You weren't in the same time frame, obviously, but you...
You know, I was able to read... You know, if they went down on the battle scenes, I hired a guy to take me, you know, roughly where they were, and, you know, I read enough about the history of it, so I was able to reconstruct what had happened, what it looked like. I was able to reconstruct... You know, this Catholic boys' school, Casalpina, is no longer there. At Casalpina, there is a Casalpina, but it's a hotel for skiers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, using pictures that I had from before and, you know, and other stuff, I was able to go onto the mountain and figure out exactly how the escape routes worked. I was able to ski, you know, to the backside of Valdole, where there's a little triangle of Italy that juts into Switzerland. And it's right there. It's wooded, and I've been in it. You know where they used to meet the guys from Switzerland who would pick them up, take them down into the village of Interfera, just below that Emmett Pass.
You have a valuable asset in the fact that you can have, like you said, some kind of get together where you can speak in front of people, but you also have the ability to tell, to help people who are going through things that you went through, the wanting to be dead, the wanting to be, that feeling that life was over for you.
Well, it's your feeling that you're not enough.
Right, but you know what that feels like. So you have the ability to really help a lot of people out there.
It's fun. You know, I did set out to write the book because of that, but it certainly became that. I mean, I think anybody can take, who's been through a difficult time can relate to it, and to see that there is a way past all difficult times.
I mean, you can take what you have and really help other people. And I think when you go through something like that, you want to help other people because you want to tell them, you know, I know what it's like to go through. I know what it feels like. I know that desperation.
Sure.
And it's such a wonderful thing to be able to help. And even if you only help one person, it's worth it. I mean, that's the beauty of it. You don't have to, I mean, you may help 1,000 people, but just helping one, it makes it worth it.
Yes.
If you stop one person from doing something tragic. And we all have been, I guess we all have felt some kind of desperation in our lives. You know, we didn't do enough. We didn't fulfill our dreams, or we didn't do, you know, obviously writing is a lot of your dream.
Oh, yeah.
But what haven't you done in your life so far that you would like to do?
I'm still trying to figure that out because I have reached almost every goal I ever set for myself. So I'm.
But you mean there are some that you haven't?
Well, I haven't been to India yet. I want to go and spend quite a bit of time. I'm utterly fascinated by India. I don't know why.
Is that an attainable goal?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll probably go there the year after next. I'm kind of booked out for another.
Maybe you'll get lucky and you'll have a story by then that takes place in India.
Maybe I'll have a story that takes place in India.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, the sky's the limit. You just don't know. I mean, we have writers out there almost 90 years old. They're still writing. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't...
I'll never retire.
Why would you? I mean, it's too much of a challenge.
Yeah.
Sitting and doing nothing, relatively speaking, sitting and doing nothing rather than writing is not a thrill.
No.
I mean, I remember when Stephen King talked about retiring. He's never going to retire either.
Right.
It's in you, that ability to write, that wanting to write, that wanting to challenge yourself.
Yeah.
So how do you... So your goal would ultimately be to have an even more spectacular story than Beneath the Scarlet Sky.
I suppose it's the best story I ever heard, so it's going to have to be truly monumental to beat that.
Or even equal. Would equal be good enough?
Equal would be good enough, and even if it doesn't attain the heights of Beneath, it would be fine. As long as it's in that same vein. I mean, you know, I think readers or writers are gifted very few monster books, monster stories like this, and I was gifted it. There's no doubt about it. So I'd like to be greedy, and if given the opportunity, I will embrace it and I will go for it.
So what will happen to your thriller career, your thriller, spy, whatever else you want to write? Are you still going to write those kinds of books too?
I haven't decided. I certainly will with Jim Patterson. I love working with him.
Mm-hmm. So that will continue.
Yeah, that'll continue for sure. And, you know, I may start alternating back and forth. I don't know.
And also, he wrote you a nice blurb for this book. Really beautiful blurb. I've never seen one like that before.
Yeah, I was shocked.
And he had to have read the whole book to write something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just write that and not follow up and actually read the book, because you always wonder when you see blurbs, did they really read the whole book? You
know? Yeah.
I mean, it goes through everybody's minds, you know, did that person really? But, and you, I'm just fascinated by you. I'm fascinated by what you're going to do next and what you've been through. I mean, you could write a book about all your experiences.
Probably.
You don't sound like you're really that thrilled to do that, but...
Well, I mean, you know, I don't write travelogues. I've done it before. You know,
right.
I write a lot of magazine stuff. But I'm utterly devoted to long-form narrative storytelling. I would love to be spend a year in Italy on the set of the film or the series, because there's, like, zero chance I would ever walk away from it.
So what do you think? What do you think, percentage-wise, are the chance that this is going to be made into a movie or TV?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, really?
Well, from my perspective, who wouldn't want to make?
Well, absolutely, I agree with you. But you know how it is with these things. People, you always hear, oh, this is being made. And, I mean, they're still talking about making Devil in the Blue City, but it hasn't been made yet. But it,
right.
That was a hugely big best-selling book. Yeah. And yours might be like that a year from now too. But you know, you just wonder. I just wonder how. That thrills me to hear that it actually will be filmed. I mean,
this is my own certainty coming through, but I've seen it as a film since right at the beginning. It was just too awesome to be, you know, right there where the Catholic boys' school was and to see the mountain and to see how dramatic it was. I was like, okay, this isn't just a book, this is a film too.
And like you said, when they do film it, it has to be done right. I mean, you can't just...
No, we can't go to Vancouver to do it.
No. A lot of things are filmed in Vancouver, too, aren't they?
They are.
It's a very popular filming point. But,
yeah, it's cheaper.
But then that's the thing. When you think about if they actually film this and do it exactly like the book is, as much as they possibly can, which who knows, budgetary-wise, I don't know what that means, what that would entail. But you cannot imagine people wouldn't be absolutely thrilled by this.
Oh, well, I can't imagine it, buddy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And yeah. And you would know it by watching it. If I'm sure you would get a chance to watch it before it would come out. But you would know if it was done right.
Right.
Because so many things are done wrong. I mean, you look at movies that were made from books, and they're just nowhere near what the book was.
No, you know, the thing that's been heartening is that the three or four people that I have spoken to in Hollywood about it, one of the very first things out of their mouth is, this has to be done right. So that's a good thing. And that's been a uniform reaction of the people who have contacted us. You know, that...
So who would play Pino? That's the big question.
I think it has to be an unknown.
Really? Why do you say that, necessarily?
I think because the scope of the budget for the project started bringing in heavy hitters at every level. It just blasts the cost through the roof, and you know, you don't know if you're going to make your money back. So I think that they would, unbroken, it was largely unknowns. That's how they did it, and it worked.
As long as the unknowns know what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you want to make sure it's going to be someone who can carry the story, who has the emotional capacity to deliver the same emotional experience that I sought to deliver in the novel. That actor has to give that performance such that anybody watching the film and or series would feel his emotions.
And that's the thing, but in Hollywood it seems like, you know, the movies get made from the big, you know, the Bradley Coopers and the Julia Roberts and you know, that's the ones that have the power to get the movies made.
Yeah, so, for the directors.
And that's what the people that are financing the film want to see. They want to see those big names.
Yeah.
And without those big names, you really have to have something spectacular. Like you said, it has to be, if it's all new people, it has to be really, really great.
Yeah.
Just to catch their attention and want them and make them want to film it. If they know they can market. It's funny how you watch a movie on cable and you'll think, how did this movie ever get made? It's so bad, you know? And yet there are bad movies made every day.
Sure.
And it just staggers the mind, you know, as far as how it got to a certain point. If it's just a bad movie.
Yeah.
But everybody has a different idea of what's bad and what's good. It makes life a lot more interesting, I guess. Do you ever have time to read for fun? I mean, your fellow fiction writers?
Oh, yeah.
You still have time to do that?
I don't have a lot of time, but I make the time. You know, I'm either, when I work out, I'll listen to books on tape if I can. And I usually buy both versions so I can slip in writing while I'm driving, or reading while I'm driving. You know, you just make time, and when I'm between books, I read voraciously.
Now, you were a voracious reader growing up, from what I understand.
Say that again, sir?
You were a voracious reader growing up.
Yes, my mother taught me to read when I was 4, and we didn't have a television until I was 11. So,
my major form of entertainment other than going outside and getting in trouble with my brother, was read. Both of us were voracious readers.
So what were you reading? What kinds of books? I mean, what...
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
Oh, I read, Robert Louis Stevenson, big adventure stuff. I read Freddy the Pig, which was a detective series in a barnyard. I loved it. I would read all the Hardy Boys series.
Oh, me too, yeah.
I read all that stuff. Then there were also, we would get these comic books that were condensed classics. So I think the first time I read Moby Dick, it was in a comic book. And then I read it for real. But having read it in a comic book certainly made me interested to read it for real.
Huh. Interesting. And there's nothing like the thrill of being a child and reading books. Because the scope is so much bigger when you're a child.
Yeah.
Because you just feel like this could be me one day. I could be a detective. Or I could be whatever it is you want to be, and you just see that and it's just fascinating. So you were able to read pretty fast, I would think.
I was ahead of the game because I was reading books by the time I was five. When I got to school, they would just let me, they'd go, here's the third grade reading program, and I would burn through it, and then the fourth grade, and the fifth grade.
I
can't remember what level I was, but it was really high, because I transferred out, in second grade to go learn how to speak French.
It's interesting. My sister reads, and she reads very, very fast. I mean, she used to read Agatha Christie in a couple hours. She'd pick up a book and read it in a couple hours. I mean, that's how fast she was. But I don't know where she got it from, because my parents were not big readers, neither one of them.
Huh.
And I guess she got it from school. I mean, where else would you get it from?
Right.
If you didn't get it from your parents, you had to get it, unless she had friends that read a lot. But I don't remember her having that. And she's an extremely voracious reader, just... I don't know if she reads so much anymore, but, I mean, the fact that she could read that quickly was stunning to me. But the question is, when you read that fast, how do you retain all that?
Yeah, I don't know if you do. I mean, I read at a fairly good clip, but I'm not burning through it. I'm trying to, because I'm always looking to be blown away, so, I open every book going, please, just blow me away.
Right.
Take me on an experience I haven't even considered ever. That's what I want.
Right. And you don't sound like you have any limits. I mean, you're not.
Oh, I'll read anything.
You're not, and that's as somebody who does these interviews and somebody who recommends books. Sometimes I read a book and I'm thinking of there's an author named Chris Carter. I don't know if you've ever read him. Who I've become very obsessed with, and he has the most graphically written books I've ever read. I mean, they're graphic to the point where I still can't get over some of them, and I've read every one he's written. And yet I think to myself, how can I recommend these books to other people if they're so graphic and so violent, and yet they're so fascinating, too?
Yeah.
It's like watching a horror movie. We're repulsed, and yet we're fascinated at the same time.
Yeah.
And why is that? I mean, why are we seem to be a culture that likes violence right now.
Yeah, I mean, but, think back. Violence has been a part of literature forever. It's always been an attempt to explain it. The interesting thing is very few people who have ever experienced real violence and real danger and a combat scenario, for example, they don't talk about it. They may be forced to write about it or somebody will write about them, but they're not going to bring up the subject to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Found that.
But you will.
Oh, I will.
You're not afraid to talk about things
now. No, I mean, I always go in telling the people I'm trying to tell the best story possible. And I'm going to ask questions that may make you be uncomfortable, but I'm asking you to reflect in a way that you may not have, or may not have allowed yourself to do it.
Right, but that ability to be able to talk about anything, that's an art. I mean, a lot of men don't have that. I mean,
if you're a reader, I think you do. You know, and I was a reporter. It was my job to ask questions.
And we're in society, we've gotten to the society now where it's open. People just want to become as open as possible about things. Because opening up yourself, it heals you a lot of times.
I think so.
And you know, you've been through it, so you have firsthand knowledge of that. But I mean, to be able to say, yeah, look, I was screwed up then, or I did something wrong then, or I went through this, or I felt horrible then. You know, it's not so bad as it used to be. It used to be you couldn't talk about stuff like that.
Yeah.
And now that it's totally turned the other way. Now everybody's telling everything.
Yeah.
Even Bill Cosby's starting to talk now. So. What's that?
I'm not telling everything.
No, not everything, but you're open a lot more than you were when you hit that abutment.
Oh, you bet.
I mean, it's just opened up your whole life.
It did. It changed me.
And
it's a very fundamental level.
Well, I miss your writing already. I'm telling you, Beneath the Scarlet Sky really did something to me reading it, and all I could think of was, where's his next book? Which is probably going to take 2 years, maybe. Who knows? Maybe next year. Who knows?
You don't know.
You just don't know. What's that?
I'm looking.
Yeah, and I'm waiting, too. And I'm sure you have a lot of people that... I can't get over the fact that 400... You said 400,000 people have downloaded it already.
Yeah.
And how many do it week by week now? Do you track that?
Oh, it's roughly 10,000, 12,000 a week.
That's a lot of people. Now, what's when they download it on Amazon, what's the price right now?
$5.
Really?
Yeah.
That's all it is?
Yeah.
Oh, what a bargain. I mean, that's a huge bargain.
Yeah.
Is that what it started at, $5 too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really amazing. Because this story, I mean, it's worth every penny. When you start it, you realize this is really something great.
Well, thank you.
Well, that's how I feel, and I'm sure that's how you feel. And a lot of people have felt that way. And boy, that's wonderful. So we'll wait anxiously for your next book. And this has been an absolute thrill to talk to you, Mark.
And you as well. And I'll let you know when the next one's coming.
The book again is called Beneath the Scarlet Sky. It's from Lake Union, which is a division of Amazon, and you can download it for $5. Wow, that's amazing! What a deal! Go get it now. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll be back next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connolly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.